You can discover how the lives of humans, red knots, and horseshoe crabs are intertwined when Deborah Kramer, environmental writer and visiting scholar at MIT, discusses her new book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey, at the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook on Friday night. Kramer depicts an inspiring portrait of loss and resilience, the tenacity of birds, and the courage of the many people who keep red knots flying. It is a great pleasure to welcome Deborah Kramer to the roundtable this morning. Deborah, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. The book is now out in paperback. Give us a sense of what this journey has been like since it was first released and having the discussion, such as the discussion you will have on Friday night at the Carey Institute.
It's been really, really exciting for me because I was so fortunate to be able to accompany these birds all the way from Tierra del Fuego up to the Arctic and to be with the horseshoe crabs when they were coming in to spawn. And it's been a real pleasure for me to be able to take all these experiences, which not everybody can have, and share them with this wider audience. It's been a lot of fun.
How did that opportunity come in the first place?
Well, I live at the edge of the sea now on a creek that used to have a lot of horseshoe crabs, but they aren't there anymore. So I just wanted to see what they would be like, what it's like. So I went down to Delaware Bay, where there are many, many more. And I went out on a moonlit night at a very high tide in the spring, and I saw thousands of them coming in. And then the next morning, I went out to the beach, and the crabs were gone, but there were lots of sandpipers running around eating the eggs that had been washed up by the waves. And I was amazed. I couldn't believe these birds were so skinny and they were so hungry and they were racing around so quickly to eat as much as they could. And I was curious where they had come from that they were so famished and where they were going that they were in such a hurry. So I decided to follow them.
And this is an annual trip, basically, from one end of the earth to the other. How sure of you were you of what that trip included?
Well, that's a really good question, because there was it's from one end of the other earth to the other and back every year. So these birds are flying 19,500 miles. And I had the route that most scientists had come to understand were the highlights of the route, but I was very fortunate that I had received some money from the Ocean Foundation that allowed me to go places that weren't necessarily on the map for the route. So I was at a meeting, and there was a really young biologist at the meeting who basically said he was seeing a lot of birds, but they didn't have the flags on them, which meant they weren't going along the route that most people understood. So I was able to go with him, and that was in the Laguna Madre in Texas. And we found, or he found, but I was lucky to be with him, another place where the young birds spend the winter and a whole other route that they take going north through the center of the country, which they used to do, but they haven't in many years.
Okay.
So the answer to your question is I didn't know the whole route, and I found some other places while I was traveling.
So does that route vary?
Well, it's pretty – the birds are trying to go where they can get the most food.
Right.
So the ones that are coming up along the eastern seaboard, most of them winter in Tierra del Fuego, some in Argentina. So you pretty much know where they are now. I mean, I've gone through all of the historical records, so I know where they used to be, so we can look to see if they're still coming there. It doesn't vary unless there's a huge change in the food supply for some reason.
So
you could go to Delaware Bay, for example, every spring, and if you were patient enough, you would be guaranteed to see a lot of birds and a lot of horseshoe crabs.
So let's begin with the birds, and tell us exactly what a red knot is.
A red knot is a sandpiper. So it's a small bird. At its fattest, it doesn't weigh any more than about a coffee cup. It's distinguished from the other sandpipers you might see on a beach running before the waves, because in its breeding plumage, it's got a real russet color to it. So it stands out that way.
And then the relationship with the horseshoe crab. So talk about that relationship, how you learned about it, and what you find so fascinating and unique about it.
Well, the horseshoe crab is an animal. It's one of the oldest animals on the planet. There are very few animals that were around 450 million years ago when this animal evolved that are here today. So this is an amazing resilient animal. It lives out on the continental shelf most of the year, and it comes in the spring to lay its eggs in the sand. And these are really tiny eggs. They're about the size of a pinhead. And for reasons which scientists do not understand at all, but which to me is, you know, just a lovely mystery, the horseshoe crabs come in to lay their eggs, and the birds arrive from South America at approximately the same time. And each crab lays about 80,000 eggs every season. And each red knot needs to eat about 400,000 eggs in the course of 10 days so it can double its weight to make that last flight up to its nesting grounds in the Arctic.
Circle of life and all of that, but are you rooting for one over the other at certain times?
Well, I'm rooting for both of them, because the more there is of one, the more there is of the other, because the horseshoe crab eggs are not really affected. The survival of the horseshoe crab is not affected by the number of sandpipers eating its eggs. The only eggs that these birds are eating are the eggs that get washed up by the waves, or the eggs that other horseshoe crabs inadvertently dig up when they come in to lay their own eggs. So these are all eggs that would die anyway. So there's room for everybody on this beach.
Okay. And when you take a journey like this and you go through it, I'm curious as to what, if there is such a thing as a routine, and what it is that you're looking for on a day-to-day basis.
You mean when I'm trying to find the birds?
Yes.
Well, it requires a lot of patience. And for me, I was basically giving myself over to the kindness of strangers. In Delaware Bay, for example, if you're going to go see the birds or the horseshoe crabs, it's pretty easy. You can drive to the beaches. You go into the New Jersey Audubon, and they'll tell you where along the bay the birds are. And you may have to drive a little bit, but you can get there. In other places, it's really, really hard. So that up in the Arctic, for example, I was with the Canadian Wildlife Service, and there were five of us, and we walked 10 or 12 miles every day looking for nests.
And were you, most days, were you lucky and got the nests?
No, we were not.
So more times there was failure than there was success?
Oh, definitely. And when the birds come back, and they're heading back now, we were in, some of them go to the Mingan Islands in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and I was with a researcher there who was showing me how he did it, and the Mingan Islands were completely enshrouded in fog. You could not see more than 3 or 4 feet ahead of you, and so he was following the sounds of the birds in the fog. If I'd been doing that alone, I wouldn't have found anything.
When you think of that and this trip, the book, what do you think the larger story is that you're ultimately trying to tell us by looking at these species, and also some of the points that you want to make at the Cary Institute on Friday night?
Well, one of the larger points, I mean, there are many, many points about this, but one of the larger ones is how it kind of let me see, I'm trying to find a good way of describing this. When I started writing this book, I realized that it had the potential for being a marketing nightmare because I was writing about two animals, not one, but two animals that most people had never heard of and fewer had seen, and most people probably wouldn't even miss, therefore, if they disappeared. So part of what I'm honored to have the opportunity to do is to invite people into this world so they can see how connected we are to it. And the best example of that is it was the birders who noticed the red knot numbers were declining because the birds weren't making it up to the Arctic. They weren't getting enough horseshoe crab eggs to eat. And that matters not just for the birds, but for us, no matter where we live, because I'm sure that there's nobody in your listening audience who hasn't either had a vaccination at some point in his or her life or had a kid with an IV line when the kid had his appendix taken out, or somebody who's had a heart stent or a hip replacement. All of our injectable drugs and implanted medical devices are safe for us to have because they don't have this kind of deleterious bacterial contamination in them, which is detected by the blue blood of the horseshoe crab. That's the only FDA-approved test for this. So our lives are completely linked to the well-being of this animal.
And the problem here is the use of horseshoe crab eggs as bait, right? So how did that, I mean, has that been happening forever and it's just become unsustainable? Or and ultimately, what do we need to do to correct that problem?
Well, the horseshoe crab, as I said before, is a highly resilient animal. So in the 19th century, millions and millions and millions of horseshoe crabs were taken out of Delaware Bay and Massachusetts to be made into fertilizer. The whole population was cleaned out. But then after the commercial fertilizer started coming on the market, nobody wanted horseshoe crabs anymore, and so the population came back. So the lesson from that is that if the numbers get low and we act soon enough, we can actually restore the populations. This time, the bait industry started really taking off, I would say, in the 1980s. And the horseshoe crabs are taken to catch eels, which, in my humble opinion, also belong on the endangered species list, and whelk. These are big export fisheries. Most people in the United States don't eat either whelk or eel. And that really decimated the population. So in Delaware Bay, there's been a concerted effort to try to regulate it. It's stabilized, but the regulations aren't tight enough, so it hasn't fully come back yet. In New England and in Massachusetts, the take is unsustainable, and we have to really cut it down. Now, there's no reason that bait fishermen can't continue to catch what they want to catch because there's alternative bait now. There's this seaweed power bar that somebody developed at the University of Delaware after she tried for 15 years to actually come up with a synthetic for what is so attractive to eels and whelk and the horseshoe crab, and she couldn't do it because this animal is really amazing. But she came up with something else. It's just as cheap as the horseshoe crab, and regulators, if they could, exercise a little more muscle, or if the public would pressure them to exercise a little more muscle, we could ban the bait industry coastwide, and that would go a long way to solving our problem.
I began our conversation by asking you what the last year has been like since the book came out in hardcover. Have you seen any indications that that situation is getting better in the Northeast?
Not in the Northeast, not yet. There's a lot of pressure to protect the horseshoe crabs in Delaware Bay. There's success, more success protecting them in the southeast region where the bait industry has been banned for many years. But the wheels of government are moving very slowly up here.
Yeah. And I ask this question a lot, so I'll ask it to you, which is, so where does your optimism lie then?
I fully believe, and I have always believed this, that the reason that we're not getting the movement on the horseshoe crab right now is simply because people don't know. I fully believe in the power of large numbers of people to change these kinds of regulations. I've seen it happen before, and I believe it can happen this time. Since the book came out, the bird is now listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act,
right. And
that is going to help put pressure on the regulation of the horseshoe crab.
Deborah Kramer will discuss her new book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook on Friday night at 7 p.m. You can find out more information by going to caryinstitute.org. Caryinstitute.org for more information. Deborah Kramer, a delight to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Joe. It was a real pleasure to be interviewed by you.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.